For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we'll be taking the first of two trips to the Boswell Book Festival. This year's festival runs from Friday the 10th to Sunday the 13th of May, so if you're listening live or on the podcast over the weekend of broadcast, that's where I am right now recording next week's show. But for today, let's take a look back to some highlights from previous years. I'll be chatting to rifleman Victor Gregg, bomber pilot George Dunn, writer and convicted murderer Erwin James, and actor Nigel Havers. And even though Red Sail is away on Holman Prize business at the moment, he'll be popping up chatting to Alexander McCall Smith, Dame Judi Dench, and we'll start today's show with Red and Gordon Turnbull with a history of James Boswell and the Book Festival for biography and memoir that bears his name.
I'm Gordon Turnbull, and I'm the head of the editorial project at Yale University, New Haven, Connecticut, United States of America, which edits the diaries, letters, and other papers of the great biographer and diarist James Boswell. He was known for about the century and a half after his death primarily as the biographer of the great Dr. Samuel Johnson, lexicographer, essayist, editor, and thunderously aphoristic conversationalist, which is the version of him Boswell has most recorded. Some of his gems have now passed pretty thoroughly into common cultural currency. Boswell also, all his life long, kept a very intimate and candid private diary, as well as retaining many of the letters he received from people, both personal ones and in the way of his legal business. Boswell was born in Edinburgh, but he was the heir of a lovely ancestral estate here in Ayrshire called Auchinleck, of which in 1782, on the death of his father, the Scottish judge, Lord Auchinleck, he became ninth laird. Curiously, Boswell is not very well known in his ancestral estate of Ayrshire. There are several reasons for this. One is he fundamentally didn't like being... He loved his ancestral estate and was fond of its scenic beauties and proud of his lineage, but he just wasn't a farmer. He just didn't like rural life, and he was of that generation that pined for the excitements and bright lights and fame that a city like London could offer, and he eventually moved there. That's the chief reason. Another one is that somehow the fame of a certain Robbie Burns has eclipsed almost all other Ayrshire literary and cultural achievement. This is a good thing. There's no denying the greatness of Burns. But it's meant that some other people, such as Boswell, have been a bit in his shadow. So James and Caroline Knox, who love Ayrshire, came along and had some great ideas, and the chief one of them was to get Boswell memorialized and commemorated in his ancestral county. As a means to that end, they inaugurated the Boswell Book Festival, first of all at Auchinleck House. After 2 or 3 years of experimentation, it grew in size and popularity such that it outgrew its original venue. I was in on it at the beginning and throughout because of my expertise in Boswell's papers. The festival, when it first began, was folksy and homey, and everybody mucked in and helped each other out. It also rained torrentially every single day from all that I can remember. The rain would be drumming on the marquee roofs. There was a lovely moment that I long cherish when a writer from Mongolia, a woman who made it out in the 70s when it was Soviet-controlled, her name was Ungula Ramsey because she married a Scotsman. She was giving her talk and the rain was thundering on the roof overhead, and she looked up and said, "It is a good thing I was raised in a yurt." But the festival grew. It caught on. It's become a cultural gathering place for Ayrshire and even further afield. In the background, you can hear the festival authors lunching and chatting happily with one another and telling each other their panels went wonderfully, whether they did or not.
And what do you think Mr. Boswell would think of the festival that has adopted his name?
Well, he'd be delighted on the whole. To go back to what I was saying at the beginning, he was just not somebody that you could keep down on the farm. He wanted to shine in a revealing letter that he wrote to one of his very best friends. He said, "I want to live so that it may tell." In the old-fashioned sense, you know, bank teller, so that it would count, signify, matter. Boswell dreaded insignificance, and he knew that he lived in an age and moved in circles that were quite remarkable. The Dr. Johnson circle. When his papers were recovered in the 20th century and the first volume of his very personal diary was published, the London Journal, 1762-1763, in the year 1950, it became a worldwide runaway bestseller. And in a curious freak of history, a book written never intended to be a book in the 18th century became a runaway bestseller in the 20th century and helped usher in a literary vogue we are now absolutely familiar with and take for granted, the confessional memoir, the personal revelation. Some years ago, I was confined at home by an illness and inflicted upon myself a consecutive week of American daytime television, Jerry Springer and such things, and was shackled to my sickbed by chains of disbelief at what people confess to on national television. This made me aware of how ahead of the curve Boswell was. The 18th century protocols of discipline and self-restraint and self-concealment were not for him. He anticipated us, so I think he would be delighted that both the works he wrote in his own time and the works of biography and memoir, which this festival, uniquely in book festivals in the world, commemorates. It's a dream come true for Boswell.
Thanks to Red Sail and Gordon Turnbull. You're listening to a special edition of Read On, looking back at some highlights from the Boswell Book Festival. And next up,
Rifleman, a frontline life from Alamein and Dresden to the fall of the Berlin Wall, by Victor Gregg with Rick Stroud. When we inspected the truck, the whole of the rear tailboard and one side of the vehicle was a mass of holes. How did we get away with it? None of us had so much as a scratch. Pure luck. The next morning, we were given a lecture by Wingy. When the enemy advanced, our job would be to keep in contact at all times, to watch what they were doing and report it back. But on no account were we to mix it with them.
I spoke to Victor Gregg and his co-author Rick Stroud at the Boswell Book Festival. Born into a working-class family in 1919, Victor Gregg, enlisted in the Rifle Brigade at 18, was sent to the Middle East and saw action in Palestine. Following service in the Western Desert and at the Battle of El Alamein, he joined the Parachute Regiment and in September 1944 found himself at the Battle of Arnhem. When the paratroopers were forced to withdraw, Gregg was captured. He attempted to escape, but was caught and became a prisoner of war, sentenced to death in Dresden for attempting to escape and for burning down a factory. Only the Allies' infamous raid on the city the night before his execution saved his life, and we'll hear about that in a moment. I asked Victor how he came to write his life story.
Well, it mainly came about, I was about 80, and I was living in Somerset, and not my daughters, but my grandchildren would keep on coming up asking me, what do I do in the war, as they always do, and I'd never told anybody. To me, the war was a subject which was taboo, so I never mentioned anything. So at that time, computers started coming on the scene, so I sat down. It took me about 3 months to write 130,000 words. There's nothing false in it. No inventions. I didn't have to invent characters. I didn't have to make up sort of scenes or problems or anything like that. Everything came out, put down as I remembered it. And that went on until one day, some years later, we was living in Winchester, and Rick had been writing a book about Alamein. Looking things up, you know. And he had contacted two officers I served with. Two officers, one of them was on the last draft with me, the last draft that left England before the war to India. So they said, well, don't talk to me, don't talk to us, go and talk to Vic down in Winchester. He's one of the last left alive. He'll tell you everything. So we went down the pub. In the end, I said, come back home with me and I'll give you a manuscript. You can take it home and take what you want out of it and throw the rest in the dustbin. So he took it home. But unfortunately, his wife, who had a senior post at Bloomsbury, happened to read it. And 2 weeks later, I was up in Bloomsbury signing my life away. So that's the history. That's a brief history of how Rifleman started.
Rick Stroud is a writer and television director, and earlier in his career, he was the associate producer of Brideshead Revisited. He's the author of The Book of the Moon and The Phantom Army of Alamein, How the Camouflage Unit and Operation Bertram Hoodwinked Rommel. And it was to Rick that Victor handed that manuscript. Rick, what was that like?
Getting the manuscript for the book that ended up being called Rifleman was a very, very exciting moment because I'd only met Vic for about half an hour and we'd been chatting, and then he suddenly said, "I've written my biography, my autobiography, and it's called The Survivor." I couldn't believe it because this was a first-hand account of most of the major events of the Second World War and all of the major events that I was interested in, which were Alamein, the Battle of Arnhem, which has obsessed me ever since I was 15, and I'm 68 now, and the terrible bombing of Dresden. So it was a major event in my life.
So, Victor, how did you end up in Dresden under a death sentence?
I was in at the start in North Africa. We was in Palestine when war was declared. And we went right the way through that. And then at the end of the Middle East campaign at Cape Bon, they was going to send the battalion back to Palestine. And I didn't want to go back. And at that time, they was asking for volunteers for this new parachute battalion. So I volunteered for that. Anyway, we went into Italy via Taranto. And then I landed up at Arnhem. I was captured at Arnhem. And got eventually into this work camp, which was on the outskirts of Dresden.
But you escaped three times.
On the third time I tried to escape, they kept recapturing me. And the chap in charge of the camp, who was an old German naval officer, he said, I've got to punish you. He said, I admire your persistence, he said, but I've got to punish you, so you've got to go and work in a soap factory. Well, nobody wanted to work in his soap factory, because it was 6 kilometres away, and this was February, and the snow was about 2 feet deep, and you had to walk it all there and all wet all the way back. See? So on the second day, he said, I'll come up with something for you, Victor, he says. You can have these wooden clogs. He gave me these wooden clogs, about an inch and a half thick wooden soles on them. He says, they'll keep your feet dry walking through the snow. When I got there, I was put in charge of shoveling this stuff, this sort of soap powder, into this big vat. And there was a big Yorkshire bloke who was already there. So the two of us were working together. So on the other side of this big workplace, there were some Italian prisoners building a wall. And they had a big pile of cement piled against it, and it was the same colour as this soap powder. So we decided to fill the wheelbarrow with cement and see what happened. And, of course, what happened was that when the German supervisor, it was all done by touch, when he thought, well, you know, take it out of the mixer, put it in the trays, then in the oven, see, make the tablets. But it was too watery. He couldn't make it out why it was too watery. So if you're going to leave it overnight and then start again in the morning. And in the morning, of course, they come down, he pulls the lever down, to start all the machinery. Of course, nothing moved, did it? Everything was solid. So the wiring all caught alight, and it was a very old building, so all the roof went up, and they quickly sussed the two of us out and sent for the local police. They come up, and as we drove away, the old building collapsed inwards. So we had to go into Dresden, go in front of this bloke, this German officer, and he said, I can't do nothing about it. He says, sabotage. He says, you'll be shot tomorrow. That's it. See? Take them away. So they took us away to this place, right in the centre, bullseye, right in the centre of Dresden, right in the centre of centre Stadt. and there was about 300 or 400 people in there. It was crammed tight. It was terrible, it was. And that night they came over and bombed it. This big blast of bomb come and landed outside the building and pushed it all in. And I got away with it. It picked me up and threw me over the other side of the building, and I was covered up in masonry and stuff like that. But I was one of the 30 or 40 who escaped annihilation on that night, and so that's why I didn't get executed. So that's the answer to that question. I'll wait with trepidation for the next one.
Right, OK, just one. What's kept you going?
What's kept me going? I ain't got a clue. I just haven't got a clue how I'm still alive. Probably it's a mental attitude half of it. I never worry about things. Life has taught me that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And you get in a situation, you cannot do anything about it. You've got to overcome the situation the best way you can. So don't worry. Carry on. So there's various things. I don't know. I don't feel any sign even now of impending disaster or termination. I just realised if I'm walking downstairs, I've got to walk down very, very carefully because I'm liable to trip up. So, yeah, I suppose it's like everything else. Why have I survived? How have I survived when all my mates, all my friends, they've all kicked it, they've all dead, and I'm still here? It's just a matter of luck, I think, and I'm grateful for it.
I left Waterloo and walked, weighed down by all my worldly belongings, all the normal army kit. I lugged it through all the familiar places, across Waterloo Bridge, up the Aldwych, along Kingsway and on to Russell Square, my old stamping grounds. My impatience to get home finally got the better of me, and I took a tube to the Caledonian Road. In no time, I was outside the two small rooms on the second floor of our tenement house in Ellington Street. By now I was a bag of nerves, but the love I was greeted with is something I shall never experience again.
Rifleman by Victor Gregg and by Rick Stroud is available from RNIB Talking Books now. All RNIB libraries, including Talking Books, are free, and you can download books on RNIB Overdrive or receive them on a Daisy CD or USB stick. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk/books. You're listening to a special read-on recorded at the Boswell Book Festival over the last couple of years. And last year, the festival was opened by Dame Judy Dench. She spoke to Red Sail.
Now, I hear you're here by royal invitation.
I am. I am here. The Prince of Wales asked me to come up to Dumfries House and do the opening of the book fair. And I said, absolutely no second bidding required. I was thrilled. I love Scotland. Love it. And so, very easy for me to say yes.
And you're no stranger to playing royal parts, both on stage and on the big screen. When you're playing a character like Queen Victoria, do you do much background research reading?
I did a huge amount of background on Mrs. Brown. Huge amount. So, I mean, I and a whole lot of other people didn't know, really, about her friendship with Abdul. It was only very recently that all the letters and things were found, written by her in Urdu, and so nobody realised what they were. And so it was wonderful, having done Mrs. Brown, to kind of, you know, think of those few years, and then suddenly she had, you know, the delight of having this lovely young man who taught her things, who she was able to talk to, who taught her to write in Urdu, who had a wonderful sense of humour, and, you know, I'm sure brought extra years to her life.
Are you a very keen reader yourself? When you're...
No, I can't read at all. I can't read at all now because of my eyesight.
So macular degeneration has taken away all ability to read text, has it?
Yes, I get taught scripts and things by friends, and you know, you adjust so quickly to something like that. Just adjust to it, and fortunately it doesn't happen overnight, but it happens during a length of time, and then you somehow adjust to that.
I know you've narrated a lot of books, audiobooks.
Not many. I'm no good at it. I tell you, the person, my husband, Michael Williams, was wonderful at it. And my daughter, Finty Williams, she's won 7 awards. She's simply wonderful at audiobooks.
And she's an RNIB narrator. I know The Tale of Emily Windsnap is actually one of my daughter's favourite books.
Oh, I'm very glad, and I'll tell Finty. She'll be very glad, too.
So do you listen to audiobooks yourself much nowadays?
No, but I'm going to start and do that. I just think I've got such a lot to catch up on. You know, I miss the whole thing, reading, and I used to paint a great deal. And I gave up painting. And then it was a friend of mine who said, you know, really, you know, you don't paint for anybody else, you paint for yourself. So I'll paint what I think I can see. And that doesn't matter. It's not, you know, for a gal. You know, everyone gets frightened and thinks somehow it's going to be on display. It's not going to be on display at all. It's just going to be for my own pleasure. So every Tuesday I go and paint. It's lovely.
And, of course, the advantage of listening to a talking book is that you can paint as well because your hands are free.
And it's so glorious, a talking book on a long journey. I mean, what could be better? If you have a long journey to do and you have a story to be told, I think it's irresistible.
Do you have a wish list that you'll be going to the RNIB Talking Books Library with?
My wish list is almost everything that's come out in the last 10 years. I'm going to be kept busy.
And obviously you're still acting as well. I heard you say on the news last night that you wouldn't stop acting until you started tripping over the furniture. Have you got...
Done that. Tripped over the furniture. Yes, I'm filming at the moment with Ken Branagh, and then I'm going to do a film with Eddie Izzard in the summer, and then I think I'm going to do another one in the autumn.
It sounds like you're keeping extraordinarily busy, and you have signed hundreds of books this morning, by the looks of it.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Keeping literacy going in the UK.
I hope so.
Well, Dame Judi Dench, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
Thanks to Red and Dame Judi Dench. At the Boswell Book Festival in 2016, I spoke to Guardian columnist and convicted murderer Erwin James about his book, Redeemable.
Well, it's a book, it's a hard account of how I became who I became, from the sort of earliest beginnings through a really challenging sort of life journey to disaster and failure, and then basically how I sort of crawled out of the deepest hole imaginable and managed to become, I think, who I should have been. I guess in a nutshell, that's what it's about.
You talked about prison libraries.
Well, prison libraries, Christ, you know, I was so grateful for prison libraries. But I was grateful that I could read. You know, so many people in prison, they can't read. I didn't know that. I didn't know when I went into prison that I had the edge on so many of my fellow prisoners just because I could read. Mm. And the prison library, they were lifesavers, prison library. In terms of books just to enjoy, but also books to make me think, books to educate myself. You know, I needed books. I was hungry for books all the time.
And you're still serving your sentence?
Well, I am, because I got a life sentence. I was convicted of murder, and I deservedly got a life sentence. But, you know, what happens is when you get a life sentence, you serve a term in custody, and then if you sort of behave and demonstrate that there's some change or some progress in your life and you're not going to be a risk to the public, eventually you get a chance. You know, I'm so grateful that I live in a country prepared to give someone like me a second chance, but we give people second chances in this country, and I got my second chance after 20 years. I was a pretty amoral character, I'm not going to lie to you. There's no, you know, I was so far away from civilized society, as you know, my criminal lifestyle was just appalling. It's absolutely appalling, and I couldn't imagine living like that now. That's the strange thing. When I was lived like that, I used to look at normal, you know, nice people who lived in nice houses and think, how do you get to live in a house like that? How do you get to be a part of a community where you have a purpose and a meaning? And I didn't know how to do that. And yet now I live like that, and I don't know how I lived when I lived on the streets. I don't know how I managed that. I couldn't do it now.
And in prison, you did some Braille transcription.
Well, when I first went in, I mean, I'd had a job. They put me in an engineering workshop, But all my job was just filing down lumps of metal. So I just sit all 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, just filing lumps of metal. And we had to do these psychology tests, psychological assessments. And then an officer came to my cell door one day and he said, the tests that you've done show that you might have an aptitude for braille transcription. They had this little braille unit, you know. And I didn't know what braille was. But I went and did a test. And then, you know, within a couple of weeks, I was doing this thing called the braille primer. You know what the primer is. And I worked through that. And it was in prison, it was the best job I ever had. You have this little thing, this little Perkins braille machine with six keys. And there was a dozen of us in this braille unit. And you know, people who couldn't see would send requests in for books or for things that they wanted to transcribe. And what I loved doing, one of my favourite things was doing, was when there was an image or a picture that needed description. So me as a writer, you know, because don't forget, I didn't know I was a writer then, but I loved doing those, you know, narrative descriptions of images and pictures. But I loved that job. Even when I look back now, it was making me smile because I was in prison and I was paying my penance and trying to, you know, make some sense of it. And I was given an opportunity to provide such an amazing service for people. It's very humbling that I was doing this. I used to do a book a week sometimes, you know. I used to blast away like a madman on this Perkins machine. In fact, the 12 of us in this braille unit were all doing long, long prison sentences. But all you could hear, all the bash, 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 and these keys going away. It was a fantastic job, honestly. It was a pleasure to do that.
And we've got something in common. We both transcribed the TV guide.
Yeah, I brought the TV guide. And it was sometimes annoying when there wasn't much description of the programme. I think they need more than that. And I think I'm trying to add a little bit more colour to it so that people could understand what the programme was about. But
did you have a TV at the time in your cell while you were doing that?
My first 14 years, there was no TV. And then in 1998, 1999, they brought televisions into prisons. And I'll be honest with you, I had mixed feelings about it because on the one hand, it took away the mental isolation of a prison cell. I could now, you know, project my mind and thoughts to a screen. And what, you know, trouble is I became addicted to Coronation Street. So, you know, you go to prison and even now I'm still a mad Coronation Street fan because I looked forward to that. You know, the banal normality of everyday life, which you don't get in prison. Prison's just one long challenging struggle to survive. But Coronation Street was always, because I remembered Coronation Street before I went to prison. So there was sort of a civilized link there. So television, I like to read in prison, you see, and television in a way can make you a little bit lazy, but I was grateful to see the outside world through a television screen, if I'm honest.
Was that not a special kind of torture, like making you do the TV guide when you couldn't watch the programmes yourself?
Before, well, in a way it was, because we had television rooms, so you had association in the evenings until about 8 o'clock, so you could watch TV till 8 o'clock, but you never saw the late night programmes. You never saw the late news or programs with a bit of a thriller or something like that. You never saw that sort of stuff. It could be a bit frustrating. We think, I wish I could see that. But, you know, it was just a joy to do that work.
And you mentioned in your talk there was a riot within a riot when someone, during a riot, smashed the TV.
Yeah, nobody could believe it. What the hell did he smash the TV? Because now we're totally isolated from the outside world. We had one television on the wing. And somebody went and smashed it during the riot, but it was the least of my worries that night, I've got to tell you.
Now, you ended up, while still inside, being a Guardian columnist. How did that come about?
Well, just coincidences, you know. I met a probation officer whose next-door neighbour was a writer, and I used to read this writer's book. His name was Ronan Bennett. And when I told the probation officer, he suggested I write to Ronan, just a sort of fan letter sort of thing, you know, appreciating his money. And I did that, and we ended up having a friendship. And then he knew somebody at The Guardian who they were talking about having a prisoner, a long-term prisoner. How do we get a long-term prisoner who can write for the newspaper to tell us what prison's like? And Ronan said, well, I know a guy. And so, you know, recommended me. Of course, then I had to do it. It's one thing fantasizing about being a writer, a professional writer, when you can write a good letter, because I was the prisoner that could write a good letter. Then when the opportunity came and I had to sit and write 800 words, first of all every fortnight and then every week, and I had to bring in, you had to be interesting, you had to have colour, you had to have information, you had to be entertaining, you had to have some moral value, you know. And it was a hell of a challenge, I've got to tell you, but it took some discipline. The thing about writing is, It takes a lot of discipline writing. And of course, people would read my column in sort of 5 or 6 minutes, but it might take me all day to write it. Sometimes it took me 2 or 3 days to write that column, you know. And sometimes I'd look at the paper and think, I wish words would come. I couldn't think of anything to write about, you know. I was always hoping for a scandal or a riot or some sort of gossip. I used to ask my two pals, Big Rinty and Felix the Gambler, say, any scandal, any gossip? I need something for my column this week, you know. But, yeah, that was amazing, that was.
You also mentioned in vivid detail what your cell looked like on the first day that you arrived in prison. Is that sort of burned into your memory?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, my first book was called A Life Inside, and the jacket cover is just a bare cell with a bed and there's not even a table and a chair there in the image. And there's a cell high up on the back wall, and it looks exactly like my prison cell. But, I mean, I deserve to be there, but the thing was, it was pretty bleak and grim. It was just flaking emulsion paint, sort of light green stained flaky emulsion paint on the walls with this small window on the back wall high up with three sets of bars on the window and a cot bed with a very, very thin, very stained mattress and half a sponge pillow, a table, a chair and a bed and a bucket for my toilet. That was it, you know, that was it.
Do you find now that when people find out about your background that they're intimidated ever so slightly by you?
Well, I hope not, because I don't find myself I'm not an intimidating person. I don't think I am anyway. But I mean, I've got quite a shocking past. So if people know me and don't know about my past, and then they find out about my past, it can be a bit awkward because it's quite hard to reconcile the person that I present now with this person who, you know, I was a very violent criminal. There's no question about that. I was somebody who caused a lot of pain and distress to other people. And I think marrying those two images can be quite awkward for some people, you know. It's a bit awkward for me sometimes. I think, how did I live like that, you know? But I think coming to events like this and sort of sharing this experience, it helps an audience to understand, but it helps me as well. It gives me some validation and some sense that that this is really happened. This has been a journey, and it's worth me continuing this journey, you know.
Is your level of rehabilitation available for everyone who goes into prison, do you think?
Well, I got a lucky break with the writing, I found a skill in prison. You know, I was never a writer; I wasn't educated. But then, because I was the guy that could write a good letter, and writing became something that I really enjoyed, I developed this skill. Even then, not thinking, "Oh, when I get out, I'm going to be a writer." Who would think that? I mean, prison serving life. You know, I wasn't thinking, "When I get out, I'm going to be a writer." I was just thinking, "Well, this is something I can do now, and it makes me feel that I'm doing something worthwhile." And then I got this lucky break with The Guardian. I got out of prison after 20 years. I was a Guardian columnist. I wrote features for Radio Times. I wrote features for had a column in The Big Issue. You know, I was being accepted by the writing fraternity as a writer. Mm-hmm. And then I was getting paid, you know, good money for writing. I was making a living at writing. So I never saw that coming, you know. I never saw that coming.
Thanks again to Erwin James. His first book, A Life Inside, A Prisoner's Notebook, is available from RNIB. It's read by volunteers and it's TB number 400358. We've heard on today's show already from Victor Gregg, and at the Boswell Book Festival there usually are one or two military events. A couple of years ago I spoke to a real-life hero of RAF Bomber Command and heard what it was like to fly over Nazi-occupied Europe in World War II, surviving a mid-air collision and fighting enemy aircraft. Here's bomber pilot George Dunn.
We were all young. We were, I suppose, a lot different to an 18, 20-year-old of today. There was no such things as tablets or smartphones or anything like that. So we were quite happy to, well, I was anyway, to have the opportunity of joining up, because when you think about it, at the end of the day, I was able to fly two of the finest aircraft in the Air Force, which was the Mosquito and the Spitfire, and got paid for doing it.
How long did the training take?
Well, I started flying in January 42 in Canada, finished in September. That was EFTS and service flying training. That was two courses. Came back to this country in September 42. Got back to this country, did a short course on Airspeed Oxfords to get used to English conditions, because of course we had blackout here, whereas Canada was all lit up. From there on to OTU on Wellington's, from OTU on Wellington's down to New York on Halifax's, and then onto a squadron. So if you say from January 42 to April 43, that will be the time factor. So that's what, 15 months? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doesn't sound very long.
You couldn't avoid the time gap, really, because don't forget you had to travel to Canada, you had to come back, and then there was a period of in a hotel at Bournemouth before going on the first course. So there's a certain amount of that time which was, you might call, dead time.
What missions really stand out to you? What ones do you really remember?
Well, of course, the main one was Peenemünde. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Peenemünde was the where the V weapons were produced. And when it was first notified to the intelligence services in 1940, but they didn't take any notice. They thought it was a ruse to divert the intelligence services for no good reason. So as the years went on, this was 1940, and don't forget the first V1 V2 rocket was not fired until September 44, because they had a lot of setbacks with the production of the V weapons, particularly the Doodlebug, which was the forerunner of the V weapon. But had that not taken place, the Peenemünde raid, we might well have been in trouble in this country, because at that time they were producing what they called the V3, which was a huge gun, which would have fired, if it had been produced, would have fired 60 rockets a minute on London. And you can imagine so Peenemünde, without doubt, was the most important raid that I took part in.
Was it heavily defended?
No, it wasn't.
Quite unusual.
You see, it was too near Berlin, and they didn't. You see, there've been lots of reconnaissance flights over Peenemünde, but they never fired on the aircraft because they didn't want the authorities to know that there was anything going on. If they'd fired on the reconnaissance aircraft, it would have given the game away.
When was the last time you flew?
When I came out the RAF in 1947. I brought a Halifax back from Egypt and delivered it to Fairford in Gloucester, and that was it.
Right. Never had the desire to get back in the cockpit?
I did win in a raffle a half an hour's instructional flight on at Goodwood when he let me take over.
Thanks again to George. We'll have Alexander McCall Smith's Books of His Life coming up in a moment, but in 2017, the Boswell Book Festival was opened by Nigel Havers.
You're listening to Read On, recorded at the Boswell Book Festival. Now, the Curtain Up event at this year's festival featured an evening with Nigel Havers, who was there to talk about his autobiography, Playing With Fire. The unabridged RNIB talking book version is read by Charles Armstrong.
By the time we came to shoot what would be the opening scene in Chariots of Fire, I had been inhabiting the skin of Lord Alfred Lindsay for several months. So, when Hugh Hudson, the director, asked if I felt able to age up in order to play my character as a man well into his 80s, I had little hesitation. The scene was a memorial service for the sprinter Harold Abrahams and took place in a London church. I had to spend 6 hours in makeup. As the face in the mirror got steadily older, I started remembering my grandfather, the way he walked, the way he talked and held his head. And as the finishing touches were at last applied, I suddenly remembered that Dad's chambers were just round the corner, so rang and invited him to come to the set and watch some of the morning's filming. When he arrived, he walked straight past me and professed not to recognise me at all until he heard my voice. I'm not sure if his reaction was genuine or whether he was doing it to give me pleasure. Either way, it was rather charming. My father was quite a guy. He had two passions, the law and living, the first providing the second. Law runs through the Havers family like blood runs through veins. My grandfather was Sir Cecil Havers, a notable High Court judge who was famous for, among other things, sentencing Ruth Ellis, the last woman to be executed in this country. My aunt is Dame Elizabeth Butler Sloss, also a High Court judge, and until recently head of the family justice system. My brother Philip is an eminent human rights barrister, and my niece Holly has recently joined one of London's largest firms of solicitors. Then there's me. Actually, I think every successful barrister has to have something of the actor in him. And Dad didn't just have a little something, he had it in spades. In 1981, as Attorney General, he was obliged to be chief prosecutor in the trial of Peter Sutcliffe, the notorious Yorkshire Ripper. On the day Dad started his case for the prosecution, I slipped into the viewing gallery. He had rung the week before to ask whether I wanted to come and see something special. "Is that the new play at the National?" I asked. "No," he replied. "I thought you might like to come and see me for a change." Peter Sutcliffe was surprisingly small, with wild, black, curly hair and very black eyes. The sort of eyes that have swallowed up the horror they have witnessed and sacrificed all life and expression in the process, leaving dark holes the colour of deadly nightshade in their place. When the judge gestured for proceedings to begin, my father got slowly to his feet. He stood, motionless, looking down at his notes. Silence. He stayed like that for several minutes, the tension building to breaking point. Just as the judge was about to intervene, he looked up, straight into Sutcliffe's eyes. Another silence. "Could you confirm how you spell your name?" he said. "One T and two Fs. Is that right?" Sutcliffe just nodded. Dad turned. There was a flurry of activity from the junior counsel huddled behind him. Everyone in the courtroom seemed to be holding their breath. Another long silence. I think the judge thought Dad had lost the plot. Eventually, Dad turned and fixed Sutcliffe with a hawk-like stare. "At least we've got that right," he said. "Tell me, did you enjoy killing those women?" The air suddenly seemed to have been sucked out of the room. It became difficult to breathe, and people started to lick their lips. I looked down and saw goosebumps on my arms. It felt as if the air conditioning had suddenly been cranked up to maximum.
So begins Playing with Fire by Nigel Havers. At the Boswell Book Festival, he told me about the book.
Well, the book is about me. I spent 3 months writing this book. 9 to 5, like I was sort of going to an office, I did it, and I was sort of rather dreading doing it to begin with, but I really enjoyed doing it in the end. And I didn't have too much interference, and there you are. It was a fun experience.
And you read the abridged version?
I loved that. I've done sort of radio and commercial voiceovers for years, so I love just talking into a microphone. I find that kind of rather restful.
Life was hell. The lack of food and sleep were beginning to turn me stark, staring bonkers. Added to which, looking back, I think I truly began to believe that I was William Wills. For the one and only time in my life, a part began to inhabit my being, and I started behaving very oddly. One day, as I was putting on my filthy old costume and having the makeup done, I noticed that the shot required us to be practically crawling on the ground. It was to be filmed by a sodding great long lens, and Graham and the crew were sitting miles away, waiting for us to get into position. "I'm not going anywhere until that director comes over to say good morning," I said. Shock registered on the face of the third assistant, this normally mild-mannered and quite cheerful actor throwing a hissy fit, or spitting the dummy, as they call it over there. He quickly walked over to Graham. "Nigel says he's not doing anything until you come and say good morning." Pause. "Has he lost his mind?" Well, I think he means it. I screwed up my eyes and watched Graham, dressed in his habitual white linen, walk the 100 yards or so to where I was standing. "Good morning," he said, and he turned on his heel and walked back. The outback can do strange things to a person. One scene took place in a dust storm, and we had to have aeroplane propellers chucking dust in our faces for 3 whole days, unimaginably foul for us. Piece of cake for Simon and the rest of the camels. Those guys can survive anything. We also had to contend with the flies. I know everyone talks about those Aussie flies, but until you experience them at first hand, you can have no idea how hellish they make your life. I wore a hat with a net whenever I wasn't actually on camera, but on one close-up a fly actually walked across my eye, right across the middle. I'm quite proud of the fact that I didn't flinch, but the secret fact is that because I wear contact lenses, I was just about able to bear it. Another time we were filming on some salt flats. You could see at least 100 miles in every direction, everything dancing in that torrid heat. The crew were about 0.5 mile away, filming with the longest lens in existence. There is only one of those lenses in the entire world because it is so expensive to produce. Directors have to put themselves on a list and queue to use it, all of which adds to the pressures of filming, as there is absolutely no margin for error. Jack and I were acting up a storm, half-crazed with thirst and exhaustion. One of us glanced over at the crew and found that they had broken for lunch and forgotten to send the runner to tell us. "I'll kill them," I yelled. Jack was able to find this quite amusing, but madman that I had become, I sulked for days.
Now, one chapter of the book stands out, your filming experience in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was because the character I played in that movie, Birkin Wills, was such an extreme, you know, to die in the middle of nowhere, and it got under my skin a bit. But it was a good experience and an amazing story.
Especially when you got back to civilization and you couldn't leave the hotel room.
I couldn't, no. I hadn't... See, we lived, you know, 800 miles from the nearest telephone or town. And after two months or so, you forget about things like traffic and noise and stuff. So when I came back to the big city, I got sort of agoraphobia. I couldn't leave. I couldn't leave the room. I couldn't cross the road. I tried to, but I just went straight back.
We eventually arrived in Adelaide, where we had a few days off before some more shooting just outside the city. It was terrifying. Suddenly, I found myself on my own in the middle of an enormous city, and I couldn't deal with the culture shock. By the time I got to my hotel room, I was a bundle of nerves, and I didn't leave the room for 2 days. I rang home to speak to Caro and give my love to Kate before I passed out. I just slept, ate room service food, and generally got my head together. The rest of the cast were doing exactly the same thing. We were all completely drained and exhausted.
Is it important that there's an accessible version of your book?
I actually have a sight problem myself, in fact. The retinal membrane at the back of my right eye is becoming unattached, so I have problems with my right eye, so I can, you know, understand how difficult it is to be blind, and I'm very aware of, you know, doing as much as I can to help.
Is that something that you're aware of on stage, like you have to be extra careful where your mark is and things like that?
I do now, yeah. I have to work much harder. It's putting a key into a keyhole is more difficult.
I realised I was grinning like an idiot. There was a light at the end of the tunnel. I knew things were never going to be easy, but there was just a chance that, together, we could get life back on track. With post-production schedules in Sydney, we weren't due back in London for a couple of months. Whatever the future held, I'd be able to take a break from playing with fire.
Nigel Havers, thanks so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for asking.
And finally, on today's show, Alexander McCall Smith is one of the world's most prolific and most popular authors. His highly successful number one ladies detective agency series has sold over 20 million copies. At Boswell last year, he spoke to Red Sail about the books of his life.
Sandy, was there a book that you fell in love with as a child or young man that made you want to become an author?
Yes, I think there was one which I read and reread when I was a little boy, when I was probably, I suppose, 7 or something like that. And that was Rudyard Kipling's Rikki Tikki Tavi. As a child, I loved that story, and I knew it more or less word for word, as children often do with their favorite book or story. The story of this mongoose who saves the life of this little boy and has this great battle with the cobras in the bungalow. And I just loved that. And I think that probably was a book or story, really, that had quite an effect on me and may have, I suppose, given me some idea of the possibility of storytelling. I remember when I was an even smaller boy, I must have been about five, I had a book which I loved so much, and I slept with it under my pillow. It was a funny little book with a blue, rather plasticky cover, The Boy's Book of Merchant Shipping. And it was probably the dullest book ever done. It had pictures of the ships and their tonnage and their routes and a few sort of remarks about them. And I thought this was the most fantastic book.
I don't think we'll find a copy of that in the RNIB Talking Books library, but we'll look for Rikki Tikki Tavi.
This is the story of the great war that Rikki Tikki Tavi fought single-handed through the bathrooms of the big bungalow in Sigauli cantonment. Dursey, the tailor bird, helped him, and Chuchundra, the muskrat, who never comes out into the middle of the floor but always creeps round by the wall, gave him advice. But Rikki Tikki did the real fighting. He was a mongoose, rather like a little cat in his fur and his tail, but quite like a weasel in his head and his habits. His eyes and the end of his restless nose were pink. He could scratch himself anywhere he pleased, with any leg, front or back, that he chose to use. He could flap off his tail till it looked like a bottle brush, and his war cry as he scuttled through the long grass was Rik-tik-tik-tik-tik.
Rikki Tikki Tavi is available in audio from the RNIB library as part of The Jungle Book, narrated by Garard Green.
And is there a book that you'd like to curl up with and reread on a rainy day?
Well, I think a rainy day I would probably go for something by Barbara Pym. Now, that's because they are, and I don't use the word cosy in any pejorative sense, but they are very cosy books. They're comfortable. There's a Jane Austen-esque warmth to them. So Barbara Pym, Excellent Women, or The Sweet Dove Died, any of these Barbara Pym novels, I would like to curl up with on such a day.
The sail room is no place for a woman, declared Humphrey Boyce, as he and his nephew James sat having lunch with the attractive stranger they'd picked up at a Bond Street sail room half an hour ago. "Now you're scolding me," said Leonora with mock humility. "I know it was stupid of me, but I suppose it was the excitement of bidding for the first time in my life and then getting that dear little book. It was just too overwhelming." "And the room was so hot," James suggested, trying to take his part in the conversation, for after all it was he who had noticed the woman in black sway sideways and almost collapse at her moment of triumph, when she challenged the auctioneer's rather bored £20 at the table, with a cry of 25? Between them, James and Humphrey had supported her out of the sale room, and after that it seemed the natural thing for the three of them to be having lunch together. Otherwise it had been a very boring sale, James thought. He had no interest in books, and had spent the time idly watching the dealers, hunched over the table in their shabby clothes, making their bids with raised eyebrows or scarcely perceptible movements of hands or catalogues.
The Sweet Dove Died by Barbara Pym is available from RNIB as read by Phyllis Boothroyd and is one of many Barbara Pym books in the library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently and would like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, I am currently working my way through Trollope, and not obviously through all of Trollope, because that would take a very long time. But I very much enjoyed recently Dr. Thorne, which I hadn't read before, and that I enjoyed very much. And so I would say, if you like Jane Austen, as just about everybody I've ever met does, then I'd say there's Trollope to be discovered, because not everybody has discovered Trollope. He was tremendously popular, as you know, in his lifetime. He was a very successful novelist, and he was extraordinarily productive. But I think these days there are many people who haven't read him, and I'd say that's a great discovery ahead for them, of just wonderfully entertaining novels. Very long, they go on and on, but they are, I think, very, very entertaining.
Before the reader is introduced to the modest country medical practitioner who is to be the chief personage of the following tale, it will be well that he should be made acquainted with some particulars as to the locality in which and the neighbours among whom our doctor followed his profession. There is a county in the west of England, not so full of life indeed, nor so widely spoken of as some of its manufacturing Leviathan brethren in the north, but which is, nevertheless, very dear to those who know it well. Its green pastures, its waving wheat, its deep and shady, and let us add dirty, lanes, its paths and stiles, its tawny-coloured, well-built rural churches, its avenues of beeches and frequent Tudor mansions, its constant county hunt, its social graces, and the general air of clanship which pervades it, has made it to its own inhabitants a favoured land of Goshen. It is purely agricultural, agricultural in its produce, agricultural in its poor, and agricultural in its pleasures.
Dr. Thorne by Anthony Trollope, as read by Eric Gillett. One of a collection of Trollope novels available in audio from RNIB.
Alexander McCall-Smith, thank you so much for sharing the books of your life with Read On listeners.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's it for today's show. I'll be coming live from Boswell 2019 at the same time next week. Red will be back in 2 weeks' time, and you can find us on Twitter. Red is at RedSale, R-E-D-S-Z-E-L-L, and I'm at Talking_Books. See you next week.